understand he did at least one of his classes. And so those of you who haven't finished those questions can get them done during the break or right at the end of class. So I mentioned earlier, my name is John Shively. I'm presently Vice President of Operations of NANA. Previous to that, I was the Executive Vice President of the Alaska Federation of Natives, position I assumed in 1972. And what Willie has asked me to do is to give a little sort of history of AFN, how it got organized, what the organization is. He says it's a little bit out of order in terms of where he is in his class presentation, but it is. There are
things that I think are relevant that will build upon discussions he's already had with you. Is there anybody here who doesn't think they know what the Alaska Federation of Natives is? You don't.
As in, what do you mean by what do you know what it is?
Well, that's the next question I was going to ask. What do people think it is? I don't do this for a living, so you're going to have a hard time reading my writing, I suspect. All right, that's an answer. Anyone else? That's all 20-some people know about AFN? Well,
it represents the people, the natives of Alaska.
Anything else? Anything anybody thinks it might have been responsible for at some point in its history? Anything else?
To
like Native corporations? Yeah, that's sort of. Anything else? Well, that's a start. The Alaska Federation of Natives, does anyone know when it started?
63?
I said 66. Okay. First meeting, really statewide meeting, out of which AFN sprang was in October of 1966. Probably the person most responsible for it was a gentleman named Emil Noddy, who has Emil lectured yet? I think Willie was going to have him. You may hear from him before the semester's over. And Emil and several other people had the idea that natives from all over the state ought to get together and talk about things. It was 1966, statehood had been in effect about 7 years. Previous to this, there had been several attempts to try to form statewide native organizations to bring native interests together statewide, but they'd all failed. But in 1966, there began to be, I think, more of a recognition that if natives didn't come together, they were going to get run over. There were several things that led to this. One was Project Chariot. Does anyone know what Project Chariot? They tried to blast an atomic harbor somewhere between Kivalina and Point Hope. And they basically, the government said, well, you know, it'd be fun to figure out whether or not we could use an atomic bomb to make a harbor, and what better than out there in Alaska where nobody lived. Well,
of course, nobody lived there except a few Eskimos. And that was one of the early issues. Another issue that I think a lot of you are probably familiar with are what I call the Barrow Duck issue, where they arrested a gentleman in Barrow for shooting a duck in the spring. And in those days, they had to try people in Fairbanks, couldn't try them in Barrow. So they were going to fly them out to try them. They went out to town, went out and shot another duck, and virtually everyone else came in and turned themselves in as having shot an illegal duck. Well, clearly the government wasn't going to put a whole town in Well, they weren't going to fly them all to Fairbanks to try them is what it came down to. And the spring duck hunting issue has, it's always been there, but there's not been a major attempt to do anything about spring duck hunting since. Another issue that affected certain natives was Rampart Dam. Does anybody know what the Rampart Dam was? What was it? At Rampart. Would have made, I think, the biggest lake in the world if they had made it. Would have flooded from Rampart. Do all of you know where Rampart is approximately?
To use this weather map. It's somewhere around here in the Utah River. It's between Tanana, it's right upriver from Tanana, you know where Tanana is. It would have flooded all the way back to Canada if they built the dam.
The idea was to provide electrical power, but the question was to whom, of course. And it would have wiped out at least six native villages who would have been underwater if they built the dam. But probably the biggest threat of all that I think brought natives together was state and land selections. The Statehood Act gave the state the right to select 103 million acres of land. As I think Willie's has probably explained to you, the Statehood Act also said that someday somebody had to deal with native land rights. But the state started selecting, and started selecting around native villages. And this became, Minto was one area, they wanted to make a major recreation area in Minto. I think they selected some land around Tanacross, which is down the highway, and then sold little like 1 square inch or 1 square foot parcels at the New York World's Fair. Deals like that. So there was a concern among Native leadership that the land issue and how the Natives related to it had to be dealt with. There were other concerns, other social concerns, that obviously were of interest too. Along with Emil, several other people were involved in putting together the first statewide meeting. One was Albert Kaloa Jr. Albert Kaloa Jr. was a young gentleman at the time, was chief of the Tyoniks. And the Tyoniks at that time had received some oil revenue from oil leases on their reservation. They financed a lot of the first meeting. They put up the money for it. They also helped finance the land claim settlement. Albert Kaloa died very tragically in a fire in Anchorage sometime in the late 60s. But he was a real state leader, and it's a real loss. Another gentleman that was involved was a gentleman named Nick Gray, who was an older gentleman who had several times been involved in efforts to try to put together statewide meetings of Alaska Natives. At the time this meeting was held, he was in the hospital, the ANS, Alaska Native Service Hospital in Anchorage. And he came to the meeting and gave one of the more impassioned speeches I've ever heard about why Natives should unify, why they should work together. And Nick Gray died within, I believe, several months after this meeting. But he had been very influential on some of the guys in terms of putting this together. Another person that was involved was Willie. And Willie had done something which I assume he's made required reading, is he wrote a little paper when he was up here at the university about native land rights and what they are. And that paper opened a lot of people's eyes, particularly in the native community, and it gave them some feeling that maybe they did have some title to land, that there was something worth working on and something they better do something about, or they were going to lose it. A couple other people, Al Ketzler, who at that time headed the Tanana Chiefs Conference, had been active for a number of years, and a number of others. So I said there were a number of, it was a week-long meeting. It was, everybody was new at this. At the time, most of the sessions were closed to the public. They discussed land rights, they discussed health, they discussed Native education. It was in October. There was a statewide election coming up. And there were several issues of concern to rural Alaska. One of the biggest ones is a fight between then-Governor Egan and some of the younger Native leadership about who should control the statewide community action program that eventually became RuralCAP. At the time, the state ran it, and there was, that was a subject of discussion. The Republicans, then running Wally Hickel and Howard Pollack, made a real effort to wine and dine Native leadership at that meeting, and I think that was somewhat responsible, particularly with, in Egan's defeat, because of the fight over the community action program. There were a lot of things that AFN did to get the settlement, and really the settlement became the reason for AFN's being in the late 60s. It became their number one priority. The majority of their efforts went into it. Florey Lekanoff was an Aleut, was sort of the first temporary president, and he was elected to sort of fill the seat until they organized. It wasn't until the spring of 1967 that they actually adopted a constitution or articles of incorporation and bylaws, and at that time Emil Nadi became president, and office he held for 4 years. I don't want to go into everything that AFN did, because I think Willie will cover that, but there are several things that contributed to AFN being or obtaining a settlement in 1971. The fact that AFN was in existence is what led to the settlement, and I think that should be understood, that without the natives coming together, I don't think there could have ever been a settlement of the land claims issue. Now, whether you think the settlement's a good issue or a good settlement or a bad settlement is something we may discuss a little bit later in the class, and I'm sure Willie, but there would not have been a settlement without some cohesive force in the Native community. But just having the issue itself wasn't enough, and AFN had to deal in areas that most of these guys had never dealt with. People like Willie and Byron Malott and Emil, all of them were young then, somewhat inexperienced. Willie had been to school in Washington. Emil Nadi didn't even like to fly, and he often drove to Washington, D.C. when he had to go to meetings, if you can imagine that. But there was a lot of learning early on, a lot of dedication to an issue, because of they all saw that if something wasn't done with the land, it was going. I mean, there's no question that if they didn't do something to stop the state from selecting land that natives wanted, the state would get what they thought was good land first. I mean, and when, I don't think this course is going to cover it much, but if you look at native selections around this state as a result of the Claims Act, almost all of them are in very key locations. They can control rivers, harbors, almost all the coastline. All natives live around the major areas that could be developed. That would have gone to the state without question if something hadn't been done. In order to get the settlement, there were several things they persuaded people to do. Probably the most important issue that AFN was involved in was persuading then Secretary Stuart Udall in 1967 that he ought to put a land freeze on all land transactions in the state of Alaska. Eventually what AFN asked was that Secretary Udall tell the state and everyone else that there was no more land transfer until the native land question was settled. And Secretary Udall did this initially in 1967, and then just before leaving office in 1968, when Nixon was to become president, you'd all put on what was called the super freeze, which absolutely stopped any land transactions in the state. As you can imagine, this was not a very popular maneuver up here, certainly not with the state government, and certainly not with most people that lived in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And that led to probably one of AFN's biggest victories during the fight, and that was when Wally Hickel was nominated to be Secretary of Interior. Now, Wally had been governor for 2 years prior to this, And he had worked on the land settlement and actually had been somewhat supportive, but there had been no ability to come to agreement on a lot of the issues like acreage and money and things that just were unresolvable at the time. How much land the natives would get, where they would get it, what kind of, how it would be taxed, all those things were discussed. Well, Hickel had always opposed the land freeze. He said, yeah, we ought to settle this issue. He always called it a moral issue. He said, the natives have no legal rights in my mind, but we ought to do something for them. The natives, of course, took a slightly different view of that subject. And when Udall had put on what was called the super freeze, after Hickel was nominated to become Secretary of Interior, he said, well, I don't care what Secretary Udall has done. Whatever he's done as secretary, I can undo as secretary. Well, if he had undone the land freeze, I think that would have been the end of any pressure to settle the claims. There's one other issue I'll get to in a minute that helped, but that was the big issue. The natives went back, and there was a split, actually, as a matter of fact, in the native leadership as to whether to oppose Hickel because of this or to just endorse him because, after all, he's an Alaskan and he understands the problem. The majority of the native leadership, though, felt that if they let Hickel go on restrained as Secretary of Interior, he would lift freeze, and that would be it. So they persuaded Senator Jackson, who was then chairing the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, that Hickel should not be allowed to become secretary unless he agreed to keep the freeze. And Hickel was probably Nixon's most controversial appointment. He wasn't liked by the conservationists. He wasn't liked by a lot of the natives. And he had real tough confirmation hearings. And so in order to be confirmed, Hickel agreed to that, and therefore Hickel never lifted the freeze. Later on, there was a lawsuit on that freeze to have it lifted, but the state had sued and said that Udall acted outside his power in putting the freeze on, and then eventually ended up suing Hickel, of course, because Hickel was keeping the freeze even though he didn't like it. That went to the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco. The Ninth Circuit Court said, yes, Udall did have the authority to put the freeze on. The case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they refused to hear it, which essentially meant that the natives had won. The fact that that freeze was not only kept administratively but supported by the judicial system was key in persuading people that something had to be done to resolve the problem of how you dealt with land in the state in terms of native ownership. AFN has always had a rocky history. From the day they were born, putting together an organization where you dealt with people from very diverse backgrounds, the needs, the lifestyle, the culture of people on the north slope of Alaska up here in Barrow are significantly different from those that live in places like Yakutat or Juneau or Sitka or even out here on the chain. Holding that together was always a struggle. And there were several things that were used to try to tear AFN apart. One of those things was when AFN decided that they wanted to hire national attorneys. Prior to that decision, AFN had generally been represented or had been represented totally by lawyers from Alaska. Mostly what you had in terms of the organization of AFN were a whole series of different groups, some of which were very old groups. For instance, the Alaska Native Brotherhood, which I'm sure Willie's talked about, who was primarily active in the Southeast. Lincoln and Ida Central Council was active in trying to obtain a legal judicial settlement of some of their claims. Yeah, the Northwest Alaska Native Association, out of Kotzebue, which really helped found the Arctic Slope Native Association. You had the Panama Chiefs Conference. You had the Association of Village Council Presidents of Bethel. You had Bering Straits Native Association, a number of them. And the conglomeration was pretty loose. The board was made up really of one representative of each group that joined. And so, for instance, Southeast had representatives from both the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Clayton Haida Central Council, and for a while, even an organization called the Five Chiefs of Yakutat, which is how they snuck fire in a lot of them. Some villages like Unalakleet had one representative. As a matter of fact, at one time, because of the way officers were elected, they had two representatives on the board. The board varied, I can't remember, initially I think it was about 18, and it went up to almost 30 before the settlement. And there was no rhyme or reason. Each of those groups generally had their own attorneys. Most of those attorneys had signed agreements that said they would be glad to help the natives get the settlement, and they wouldn't charge them, since they knew the natives mostly didn't have any money anyway, but they would take a percentage of the settlement later. Those of you who are familiar with the Act know that that was all thrown out, and Congress said there's only so much money you can get. But anyway, I personally, this is well known, don't have a very high opinion of the Alaska Bar. I don't think Alaska attracts the best lawyers, and certainly it doesn't attract the best lawyers to deal with a very complex situation in Washington, D.C. So, in about 68 or 69, the AFN board decided to hire Arthur Goldberg, who was a former justice of the Supreme Court, and Ramsey Clark, who was a former attorney general of the United States, who were both members of a couple national law firms. Well, a number of the Alaska attorneys just went bananas. And if at any time I'm going too fast or don't explain anything, interrupt me.
What was that other lawyer's
name? Clark, Ramsey Clark. At any rate, at one point, well, the lawyers in Alaska were making charges to things like hiring Goldberg and Clark was going to cost $50 million, and you know all they do is rip off the natives. And at one point, Goldberg resigned and just said, "All right, you know, I don't need this kind of stuff." But he was persuaded to come back. That was, I think, a really key point for AFN, because it brought them some national credibility. Somebody like Arthur Goldberg or Ramsey Clark could walk into any senator or congressman's office in Washington and say, "Hey, Frank, look, I'd like to do a little deal here on this native problem." Some guy from Alaska was lucky to get to talk to the receptionist, might get to talk to a staff guy, but clearly, in terms of really dealing with senators and congressmen, they just couldn't do it. Sort of interesting thing happened, though. At one point, AFN found out that, I think it was Ramsey Clark, that although AFN had one stand on the amount of money and land they wanted, Ramsey Clark was going around and saying, "Well, yeah, that's right, that's what they want, but I think really, if you want to put together a good deal, maybe rather than 40 million acres, you could go for 10, and I can't remember what else. Well, AFN found out about it and called him in and said, "Look, we don't care what you think is right. It's not an issue here. We're hiring you. Now, if you don't want to support our position, don't support our position, and you can go back to practicing law for someone else. But if you're going to work for us, you're going to promote our position." AFN had some other troubles during the, well, really in 70 and 71. A thing that almost split AFN apart was how the land was going to be divided. How many of you here have studied the Claims Act at all? Know much about it? Okay. Well, there right now in the Claims Act, two ways to get land. One based on the number of people you have, and one based really on how big your region is. Well, early on, AFN's position had always been that everything ought to be supported, or everything ought to be distributed based on the number of people. So the more people you had, the more land you got, the more money you got. Well, Arctic Slope and Doyon both
very big area, the Wasatch Arctic Native Association and Tanana Chiefs Conference. Tanana Chiefs Conference took up most of the middle of the state and Party Slope, all of North Slope, said, now wait a minute, that's not what this is all about. We're not talking about people. What we're talking about is a real estate deal. What the natives are doing is they're saying to the government, we own this land, and you're going to give us some money and let us keep some land. And how much money we get and how much land we get should relate not to the number of people we have, but to how much land we got. If we got more land, we should get to keep more land. Well, in late 1970, when Congress was very close, the Senate had passed the bill, and Congress was somewhat close to maybe dealing with the issue, Arctic Slope walked out of AFN, just said, we will not be part of this, it is not fair to our people. As a result, AFN met, and at the time their position had been that land, there should be 40 million acres of land in any settlement. And it should be, as I said earlier, based on the number of people. They came back and refined that and upped the amount of land they wanted to 60 million acres from 40 in order to accommodate what became known as the land lost formula, or how much land you lost. That compromise was pretty critical in AFN's history. Unfortunately, in some ways, that episode also was to be repeated much later in AFN's history with Arctic Slope and other regions leaving AFN, and I'll get to that later. But 1970 was really the first time anybody had just pulled out of AFN and said, we're done with it, you're wrong, we're going someplace else. Arctic Slope was satisfied with the compromise and came back in, I think in early 1971. A couple other things that were important in getting the settlement to AFN. The oil industry all of a sudden realized that unless something was done about this little problem the natives had raised, they weren't going to get the oil out of Prudhoe Bay. There were two reasons for this. One was the land freeze. The other was a suit known as the Stevens Village suit, which was brought by Alaska Legal Services to say that the government couldn't take any land from around Stevens Village for the pipeline until the claims were settled. That suit also went to the Ninth Circuit Court, and the Ninth Circuit said, that's right, settle the claims before you give any of that land away. So the oil industry is stymied. Key in breaking the sort of logjam in Congress of how to resolve this issue was how much land. And prior to 1971, no congressional committee had ever dealt with any more than 10 million acres of land. The natives had always said at least 40, they were now up to 60 million, and the Department of Interior, the two congressional committees both said no, 7, 10, 5, there were all sorts of really low figures. In 1971, Spiro Agnew, who was later to gain fame for doing other things, met with the National Council of American Indians in Kansas City, and he chaired President Nixon's little committee on Indian Affairs. And the Alaska Native leadership through AFN had a meeting with Mr. Agnew and persuaded him, with the help of an Indian on his staff, that he and the Nixon administration ought to support 40 million acres. That was the only way to deal with this. And he did persuade President, or somebody persuaded, I suspect it was a combination of the vice president and also the oil industry, although the oil industry would never admit to it, just said, look, we need to settle this problem, we need to get at that oil, and if all it takes is 40 million acres, there's lots of acreage in Alaska, give them the 40 million acres. And so Nixon supported 40 million acres. Well, then the Democrats were in control of Congress. Liberal Democrats were always supposed to help minorities, and they had Nixon, who's always supposed to be running over minorities, being far more liberal on this issue than they were, and they just couldn't afford that. So once Nixon came out and said 40 million acres was okay with him, then it became okay with the Senate and the House, and by the end of 71 the issue was resolved. But
in order for AFN to sort of keep all that going was a real test of anybody's skill. And particularly when you talk about people that had virtually no political experience. And, you know, I think there's one thing that...
What happened? People got out of there. What was the stuff behind people leaving?
Well, that really had nothing to do with the settlement. Hickel, can I answer that question in a minute? Oh, okay. Wally Hickel has quite an ego, as those of you who may have dealt with him knows. And he had just come from running a state which has probably the most powerful governor in the nation, if they want to be. And Hickel ran the state that way. I mean, he ran it. If he didn't like what a commissioner was doing, he fired him. I mean, he didn't have any bones about it. But he went to Washington and found out that being Secretary of the Interior wasn't worth much, that Haldeman and Ehrlichman and all those guys in the White House were running the show, and that being Secretary of Interior meant that he could hardly even ever get to see the President, and he didn't like that. In addition, due perhaps to the fact that he has a number of sons, I think he was becoming concerned that some of them were going to get blasted away in Vietnam, and he had some problems with Nixon's approach to the war, and he wrote Nixon a long letter about that, as I recall, which he leaked to the press, which did not please the President at all. And shortly after that, Wally moved back home. He was a hero, I mean, nationwide, for a guy that started out with most of the liberal community opposed to him. He became a hero for a while. Anyway.
I was wondering about the injunction.
I wasn't involved directly, but I know a little bit about it.
That's why the line was for the land settlement, wasn't it? Because they put an injunction on it?
Well, yeah, there were two things that held up the pipeline. There were two lawsuits. One was a native suit that was brought by Alaska Legal Services that said, you can't let pipeline Alyeska go across this land until you figure out what the natives own and don't own. Now, as part of the settlement, Congress just said, this is a pipeline corridor, and identified it, and almost none of it is on native land. There's a little bit that Alyeska needed because they didn't know really where they wanted to go in the Otter region. They just carved it right out and said, natives don't get any of this land as part of the settlement. So it was dealt with as part of the settlement. The other suit that held up the pipeline was a suit by the conservationists that had a number of issues involved in it, including the fact that the environmental impact statement was not sufficient. That was what the conservationists said. Well, Congress did about that later, is they just declared the environmental impact statement sufficient. And so therefore the court had no authority. That was Mike Gravel's finest hour. Former Senator Gravel. Does that answer your question? Anyway, that got AFN to the settlement. Are there any questions about any part of that? Okay. Let me just ask a couple of questions that really don't I'll relate a little bit to the subject. How many people here think that the Settlement Act... Do you have a question before?
Yeah. How do they decide on the money? How much money to allow?
Well, that was complicated too. The natives wanted, as I recollect, an unlimited 2% royalty on all mineral development in perpetuity forever. And they wanted between $500 million and $1 billion in direct cash from the federal government. And what they did is said that the federal government gave $462 million, and then there was a 2% royalty, but it stopped after when reached $500 million. So you got almost $1 billion in money. The federal payment was spread out over 11 years. The 2% royalty was dependent upon when oil was developed.
Okay, so that 2% from the large flow is already
Well, yeah, the state prepaid the rest of it last June. Actually, it was still being paid, but the state, because they got a lot of money sitting around, said, here, let's get rid of this problem. It wasn't quite that easy, and I'll discuss that because it is another issue that AFN gets involved in. I'll discuss it a little later.
Yeah, Lincoln? Do you think that was a fair payment, and then the other one was, how did they distribute it between the regions?
Well, I'll answer the second question. They distribute it based on population to the regional corporations, who then essentially have to take half of it and distribute it to their village corporations, again based on population. I was going to ask you guys the first question. And I'm serious. That's right here on my notes. It says, ask about provisions of the Settlement Act and whether or not it's fair. So I'd like some discussion of that. And just, I mean, not detailed, but do people in here have an opinion about the Settlement Act and about whether or not it was a good deal or a bad deal?
I think it's a bad deal so far because it's been 10 years and a lot of the corporations got less than half of the land to this day have gotten less than half. I know for a fact that one for sure has gotten less than half.
Well, yeah, overall, of the 44 million acres that are involved in the Settlement Act, only about 17 million have actually transferred.
Isn't that a reason why you could probably fill the Settlement Act and do it all over again, do something like that, isn't it?
No, because it's a matter of processing. It's not a matter of the government saying you can't have the land, just they haven't gotten around to transferring. Like the state. The state was entitled to 103 million acres, which they felt they'd probably have by, oh, the late 60s, early 70s. As a matter of fact, there was a deadline originally, which the Congress has had to set back several times. Part of the reason was because the natives held all the state conveyances. So if the federal government was busy taking the land back, I think your point would be perhaps well taken that you might be able to try to do something. But the land's there. Nana's position, for instance, has been, and we have very little of our land, is it's not going anywhere. Our rights are established on our selection areas. We know approximately what we're going to get. If the government wants to pay for managing it rather than us, that's their problem.
Well, the thing I'm worried about is when another 10 years come by, we're going to be paying taxes for land we don't even have, ownership of.
Well, we resolved that problem in the D2 bill. And that's an excellent point, because what Congress said in the original Claims Act was that after 19, you're free from any taxes on undeveloped land until 1992. We pointed out to the government, I was involved in lobbying some of the amendments through the AFN got on the D2 bill, said, look, this is ridiculous. Everyone felt that we probably have our land by 1975, 76, the latest, and we got nothing. And so the freedom from taxation is meaningless. And so they said, yeah, that's right. So what it says now is that it's 20 years from the date you actually get your land. So if you don't get your land in the year 2000 and you don't develop it, you don't get taxed in the year 2020. So that's even a little more protection than you have, because it's probably the most protection we're going to get is about 15 years under the old law.
Where can I find the information?
If you check with Senator Stevens' office here in town, or Congressman Young, or probably even Senator McCaskey's office, and just ask him for a copy of the Alaska Lands Bill or the Alaska D2 Bill. And it's the sections that relate to natives are primarily Sections 9 and Section 14. There are 37 amendments to the Claims Act. Over half the D2 Bill relates to Alaska Native issues and amendments.
Which bill should I have?
The Alaska Lands Bill. Or D2 bill, either one. I mean, it's the same bill.
20 years from what date?
The day you receive conveyance.
Of a particular parcel. So
right.
That means it's going to be spread out over a period of time.
Absolutely. If you've got land, say,
back here and back there, and you get this in, say 2178, and this one comes in 2028, and before, You get 20 years from 1978 for this piece and 20 years from 1994 for this piece. All right, back to my question.
Other reasons why people don't think it is a good deal or think it's a bad deal. Michael?
My first, right now, my impression is that it would have been really good if they would have been able to hang a percent, because 10 years ago, $1 billion was one hell of a lot of money. But nowadays, especially with the amount of the price that the oil has gone, and with, you're talking about $4 billion just to move the capital for the fun of it, and it's nothing, you know? There's so much money from it that $500 billion is nothing for this state.
That's a good point. But in 1971, when this passed, the whole state budget was around $200 million for everything. Yeah. 1969, it was $150 million. I know that for sure. And, you know, nobody knew what was going to happen to oil prices. I mean, in 1971. People had known that the 2% royalty might have been different. And obviously, the more money you get, the better settlement it is. So, you're right.
Wasn't it kind of fair? I know there was a blanket claim before the settlement, and villagers got mad and they started blanket claiming. Wasn't that more land? There was more of a percentage or a billion.
I don't understand your question.
I thought you know what I'm talking about? Well, after the state started collecting land, natives started getting mad, and the villages started laying out big blanket claims.
Right.
And this supposedly covered two-thirds of the state. I'm not
talking two-thirds. And actually, it's probably more than the whole state, because in many cases, those claims would overlap.
Uh-huh.
They were mostly, what happened is the native associations, like Nana or Tanarachi, would go to their villages and say, you tell us how much land you use, and then they combine all that together and make one big claim for the whole area. Yeah, they claim virtually the whole state. But the deal is, in the United States, on Indian claims, is that there is a title that you get through use and occupancy, which is what the natives claim. They claim that title. But Congress has a right to decide what to do about that title. They could have done any one of a number of 100 things, probably. They could have come in and negotiated treaties, just like they did with the Indians in the South 40. Probably could have even just come in and said, yeah, they're claimed, and we hereby buy them for $1. I mean, there's no measure for what Congress can do. It's not how Congress feels. They basically could have wiped them out. What they said was, yes, there are some claims up there. We want a deal. Actually, what they said was, we don't know whether they're claims or not, but let's ignore that. This is the deal we're giving the natives, and if there are any claims, they're done. And that is supportable under the way the U.S. Constitution works. So, Aboriginal title based on use and occupancy is not the same thing as having something on paper. And Congress determines what's on paper. And so there was a tremendous reduction in terms of the amount of land. You went from over 365 million acres of claims to 44 million acres of settlement.
Isn't that how
That's a different law. That's the allotment law. That was passed in 1906.
And people in our area began claiming that
you used enough. Well, yeah, but not what I was talking about. The 160 acres, the native allotments, was like a homestead. You know what a homestead is? Except that rather than go out under the Homestead Act, you had to go out, cut down trees, and basically farm. Well, in most areas up here, farming wasn't a real good deal in the rural areas. And so Congress said, well, natives should be entitled to get 160 acres too, but we'll give them different criteria. And the criteria was that you could prove that you use the land, like fish camps or berry picking or wood gathering or whatever. And although that law went on the books in 1906, between 1906 and 1969, there were something like 200 allotments
that were approved, even though
Father.
Doesn't know what ROCAP is? ROCAP is a community action program. It's originally funded under the War on Poverty. And it ran things like Head Start programs and community organization programs in rural Alaska. It helped fund a lot of the rural meetings on land claims with Native associations early on. Anyway, ROCAP, the Alaska Federation of Native, Alaska Legal Services, got together and said, look, we know that one of the things Congress is going to do when they settle the claims is they're going to do away with the Allotment Act. So we better tell people about it so they can go file. And which we did, and there are about 8,000 or 9,000 applications filed in about a year and a half. Now, that's separate from the Claims Act. That's the right they had prior to the Claims Act.
It doesn't cut into that 40 million
acres at all? Well, unfortunately, the answer to that is yes and no. Getting a little off where I intended to be, but any allotment that was processed, approved by the government between 1971 when the Claims Act passed and 1974 got counted against the 40 million acres. But because the government was so messed up, they didn't process very many. Because we kept harassing them so they passed the deadline. So not very many counted against the 40 million acres for a few years. That law did get wiped out when the Claims Act passed, because there is no more allotment.
I don't think the verdict's in yet. It seems to me that some of the effects of the settlement are yet to be seen. For example, the effect of tax on 20 years, even on a deferred scattered basis. The effect of being able to, in 20 years, sell the shares. Nobody knows what that's going to mean, whether or not we're going to get some big multinational corporations coming into the state, buying up shares, and as a way of getting control of land, and so on. So I don't think the verdict's in.
How would you respond to that in light of Indian history in the United States?
Well, of course, in light of Indian history, you've got to be pretty skeptical about what's going to happen. On the other hand, in light of the ability that AFN has had to substantially improve the settlement in the last 10 years, I think you have to say, at least at this point, they've been able to deal with a number of the substantive problems, like the taxation problem, and there are others which really we don't have a lot of time to discuss today. Maybe we'll discuss a few more after break. So I would, from that perspective, from what the government's going to do to the Alaska Natives, the verdict clearly isn't in. You know, maybe things will get lots better. Not something worth betting on, I suppose, but and maybe they'll get a lot worse. But clearly, from that perspective, the verdict's not in. from the business perspective, obviously the verdict's not in. Early on, a lot of corporations had a lot of trouble. Some of them are still in trouble. On the other hand, if you look at the more recent history of the regional corporations, you see a more positive trend. You see them doing better. Not as well as General Motors, perhaps, but for many of them, slightly better than Chrysler. So, considering that from the business perspective, you started with people who didn't understand anything about business, who had never operated in the corporate world, I think you got to say it's been better than a lot of people would have guessed. But for the real critical issue, which is land, I have to agree that probably the verdict really isn't in. We don't know what's going to be done with a lot of the land. We don't know whether that land is at all valuable. We don't know what's going to happen to the state in terms of the number of people, which is obviously going to affect what happens to land and land use. The land in the long run is the key to the settlement. What happens to that land, what use people can continue or want to continue to make of it, in my mind, it's a personal thing. And before we go off for 5 minutes, to answer my own question, if you take it from the perspective of Congress, the settlement was the most generous they've ever given to any Indian group. No question about that. The problem is what you're measuring against isn't very good. You know, I mean, they have not done very well by American Native people in Congress. So to say it's the best is to say it's the best of the worst, perhaps. If you look at the money, even in 1979, it was my opinion that it wasn't at all fair, which is what Congress, particularly the Alaska Congressional Delegation, tried to portray that it was fair, because the state received almost the same amount of money, $900 million, just for giving the oil companies the right to punch a few holes in the tundra in Prudhoe Bay. They paid $900 million just to go up there and put drill rigs and drill holes. That's all they paid. Not a dime of that was for the oil. That was just the right to look for it. So if you compare those two figures and you say that Alaska's natives had a claim on virtually the whole state, $900 million is a little cheap. The 44 million acres, on the other hand, particularly looking at other settlements, was from a congressional standpoint a lot better than I think many people hoped for. And I think it was a surprise. I think the issue is not so much whether it was totally fair, because it's hard to argue that. I don't think you can justify it if you look at it as a land deal. The issue is what happens if you don't take it? You know, What would have happened then? Well, what would have happened, I can guarantee you, because the nation was getting real hungry for oil, is the pipeline would have been built, the state would have gone and gotten their lands, and Congress would have gotten around to resolving this problem later. And whether it would have been better or worse, I can't tell you. I think from a land standpoint, it would have had to be worse because some of the land would have been gone. It might have been more money. But clearly some of the better land would have been gone. If you look at the settlement as I do, as being the land, because that's what the people are closest to, then I think the judgment was correct to take it. But it was a guess, you know, and none of those guys didn't know. Now, Willie will tell you this. I mean, there was a lot of pressure on that. Nobody had ever tried this before. I mean, there isn't a piece of legislation Congress had ever dealt with like this for Native people when the Alaska Natives tried it. It was totally different. And it was slammed together right in the last few minutes of the Congress. And there have been a lot of problems with it. There have been, how many people here know what 7I is? Section 7I. Nobody. And if you knew what 7I was, you'd be busy preparing for law school. 7I is a section of the Act that says that if a region develops its timber resources or subsurface resources, they get to keep 30% of their revenue and they share the other 70% with all the regions, including themselves, based on the on population. So, in other words, if we're NANA and we sell an oil lease for $1 million, we get to keep 300,000, and we share the other 700,000 among all the regions, including ourselves, and because NANA has about 6% of the population, we'll get another, whatever that equals out to be, another $40,000+. So out of the money we'll receive, we get 340,000, and the rest of the areas get the rest.
How much of that 300 would go to village?
Aha, that's a good question. That's being litigated. Regions say zero, and well, at least one village says half. It's clear that half of this goes to villages. Now, villages also, let's say there's oil development, could get money from leasing the surface of the land for, because what you're dealing with in an oil lease is what's under here, and if they got to, the oil company's got to come in and put up a drill rig and some other things, they got to lease land to do it. So the village might get something of that. It's not decided though, it's being litigated. And NANA, for most cases, doesn't make much difference because 10 of our villages merged, so it's all the same. Anyway, that one section, in terms of, to get back to a point that I think I was trying to make, 7i went to court in 1974 basically to determine how you figured out what this $1 million was. And it's still there. And it's the biggest mess you've ever seen. It has been, and as I wrote our attorney just this morning, I think we're in worse shape after 7 years of litigation than we were when we started. And it's cost literally hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we haven't even dealt with very difficult issues. So there are things like that in the Settlement Act that have been very difficult and very costly that have hurt, some of which I'm going to get into later in today.
Is the word revenue?
The word is revenue. All revenue. Now, revenue is not even the appropriate word to begin with. It's often more of a tax term than a business term. But what is all? Well, the one court decision we have says all isn't really all, it's part. Well, if it's part? And what can you deduct against it? Well, and that's where you get into all your fights as to what's deductible. If it's not all the revenue, what can you deduct from the $1 million? What kind of expenses can you deduct? I have piles of paper since I handle this for NANA, not as a lawyer, but as in our administration, that are literally that high right now, that's just been produced in about the last 8 months. Say nothing of what's been produced in the last 6.5 years.
Conceivably, your expenses could exceed your
cost. Well, unless somebody hits some oil, yeah, that's true. But anyway, there are things like that about the Settlement Act because of the way it was put together that it also make it a bad deal. A number of those Congress has been willing to deal with. Some, like 7i, it's not able to deal with. All right, I'll let you take 5 minutes. I don't know what. 5 minutes, good? Get started. Try to get back on the track a little bit. What I'm going to try to do, we've had a lot of, at least I've had a lot of fun answering questions, is to get through most of what I plan to get through in the next hour or so, and then one say the last 45 minutes. So general questions and claims back at me if you like. Let's see how far I get though. Since I have 5 pages of notes and I'm on page 2. This will go fast. All right. Well, here we are in 1971. Let's say we're January 1st, 1972. The Claims Act is passed. What does anybody think that's going to happen? Is it in the bill?
something like AFM to claim that? What?
Well, coming in, and they had all these debts. Now, loans are a good thing. the question was, how do you deal with these laws? And what happened was that regions agreed in the middle of 1972 to what was called the Save AFN Amendment. The amendment that passed quickly through Congress said that the regional corporations, through money they were to receive from the settlement act, could loan money to AFN out of that money and allowed for early payment to the regional corporations. They ordinarily would not have gotten this money until 1973. After the all the natives were counted, after the roll was finished. So that took care of the loan. But how do you operate it? Well, who's got all the money in 1972? Where's it all going to be? Where's the money in the settlement? It's not in AFN, not in the statewide corporation. Where's it go? Right. That's where it is. So then how does AFN survive? Reorganized AFN, formed a corporation that was made up of one representative of each regional corporation, and elected the president, Willie Henson. That was a big problem, huge fight over that. Don did not, he did not like that. Tried to get the region, she was originally from Goyon. John Sackett, who was then president of Goyon, helped lead the fight to reorganize
Smith and tried to get up here and came up, made a presentation to the Doyon Board, and of course, John's not going to change his mind, but there was that kind of thing. And Willie took over, I think, September, October, November of 1972. What he inherited was an organization that had, I think, 6 or 7, as I recall, federal programs. All the money that was spent, all the money that was spent, really, federal programs that helped the money was caught except in one program. The region was saying, well, of course, we got rid of Don, and that was really nice, but we don't really have all that much money. We don't have the money. The reason I know so much about that is because in November, I was down peacefully on a beach in Hawaii, having announced the board of directors of the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. I was the director at that time, but I was resigning and trying to make a law. I got a call from my friend Willie. Hey, you know, like program ends. I really need somebody with administrative experience to consider coming to work for me. Well, I said, well, Willie, I'm on vacation in Hawaii, but I don't want to make a decision like that. Plus, I don't know. Well, I need to know tomorrow. Well, I said, well, that's real nice. I'll think about it. Well, I mean, I had a hard time with that. Was to me an honor to be asked. And I had been at the first statewide meeting that held in Athens, because a friend of mine, Byron Watson, said, hey, you've got to come to this because I think it's what's happening here is real important. And I thought statewide organization was pretty important to the personal team. So I decided to accept Willie's invitation. But instead, I went to work and said, well, it really was the message that it was in. Really did something I'm not sure anyone else in the state would have done if it were an emergency. Really served without power for virtually the entire time he was president of AFN. They eventually paid him. But he was a legislator then, a little bit of money coming in because of his legislative salary. And, you know, he put trips to Washington on his credit card. I got audited on the IRS expenses because I wrote off so much business expense I didn't believe it. And it really was such a show. We were in a lot of trouble with federal government because of the way some of the federal programs could run. There really was little hope, and basically, a friend of mine, Sam Stevens, who became one of the presidents of the AFN eventually, said to me, Earl, look, John, you can probably take a couple months to put all this together, and after that, this isn't going anywhere. Mike Cavell or somebody, why don't you go to work for Mike? And I said, yeah, I think that's a great idea. And I committed to Mike, actually, to go work, but I never did. Anyway, we scraped and we put the thing back together. But most of the readers felt there's no reason to have it. We got a settlement. Right? Can anybody guess why we needed to? A reason. Well, who came to the rescue of AFN but the federal government? The federal government doing this by giving AFN money? What the federal government did is they attacked the region. They started writing regulations as to how to implement the settlement act, how people could collect money, where they could. easements would be on that land. Those regulations were designed to replace the entire country. Basically, take away much of what has been wrong with the land rights of the natives. They came out with the first set in September 1972. That was so bad it was short of the board. In March 1973, they came out with the second set, which was the worst. And so what happened was that regional corporations, other than Arthur Bloom, got mad again on the left, got together and said, look, you know, the only way to fight these guys is together. If we don't stick together, we're going to tear us apart on the land surface regulations. It's really Department of Interior and the land surface regulations that pulled AFN back together, gave them a reason for being. Now, whether or not it will come later, I don't know. But it's such a clear and apparent threat to the regional leadership that they combined. And there are a couple of points that we have to understand, as I said earlier, there's never been a settlement like this, and nobody knew how to handle it. It probably should have been handled by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because at least they understood a little bit about Indians. There are certain things to do when you're dealing with Native that you don't do when you're dealing with the public. When they put the Administration of the Claims Act in the Bureau of Land Management, never dealt with Indians except to take their land away. So I figured, well, 100 years taking Native land away, that must be what we're supposed to do now. So, I mean, that's what they've been trained to do. So they did it. Tried to do it. I don't think any of it is thrown AFN out of this, but that's just the way they dealt. AFN points that they felt the federal government had to recognize dealing with the Settlement Act. First was, the Settlement Act required Native participation in any decision that was made. We had the right to go and meet with government officials, meet with the Secretary of Interior, and negotiate our land, our regulations. Then when that's not allowed, under the Administrative Procedures Act, the government will publish regulations. Let's say they have 30 days to comment. Say they publish what are called draft regulations. Give you, say, 60 days to comment. Okay. Got a comment right here. During this period, you can talk to federal officials. Regulation. Once comments are posed, then they have a period of whatever they want, in which they take all the comments and go to some point the final resolution. Okay? In this period, when they're really making their final decisions, ordinarily people cannot go talk to government officials. Conflict of interest, the government officials have done here and apply it to here. We said, look, the Claims Act says that we are to participate in all the decisions affecting our land rights. Therefore, you have to talk to us. And we won that. They did negotiate with us. We spent in May of 1973, 2 weeks in Washington. And we went back there and we said, look, we're going to meet with you guys till we resolve some of these problems. And we don't want to meet with the little lawyers and all the little gnomes. Do this. We want to meet with the people that make policy, like the assistant secretary, the secretary. Well, they were amused by all that. These people wanted Alaska, so they set up a little meeting right at the beginning with some of the policymakers, and said, "Well, and we're now turning this over to our lawyers." And they walked out. We said, "Well, that's fine. We're turning it over to our lawyers too." And we walked out, and we left the lawyers there to battle back and forth, and refused to go back into the room. So they got people we could deal with. That went on for 2 weeks. And it was a tough experience, expensive experience. It was a real learning experience for someone like me. But at the end of that, we had substantially changed the land selection regulations. Now, we still not resolved all the problems. But we
for instance, under the original regulations, somewhere between 11 and 40 recognized native villages wouldn't have qualified because of the way they defined the village. None of the larger native villages, like Bethlehem, Crossview, Dillingham, any of them, all they, virtually anybody that had been lucky enough to get a water system would have been eliminated. Virtually what they did is they made a measurement, and the better off were, that meant they weren't a native village. It was just ridiculous. There were selection criteria as to how you could select your land that was designed to make sure you got lots of bad land and allowed no flexibility. And we changed that. We said, look, natives should be allowed to select basically where they've used the land. No point taking a select a mountaintop if there's land over here that people have used. And we won that. They said that, well, every time you're going to get a conveyance of land, it should be published in a newspaper. And you should pay for that publication. And we said, well, we don't want to publish it. Why, if you want to publish, you pay for it. We don't want to pay for it. They bought that. They paid for it. So it was that kind of thing, but there were probably 100, 150 different issues that we dealt with. And that really gave the native groups a few problems about AFN. Wow, did we get the settlement? We got it because we stuck together. How are we going to keep it? And that's the key, getting it. Although it was difficult, it's the easiest part of this whole deal. Keeping it was what the challenge was. So keeping it forever, getting it was 6 years. So people began to realize that if they didn't stick together, the government, the state government, the federal government, was going to try to knock them up. So that experience was very beneficial. Second big issue that helped keep AFN together was this little item called this was a real attempt by the government to give with one hand and take with the other, in which they were saying, well, of course, you can own all this land. All we want to do is make sure that everybody can always use it. Either they're your people or sportsmen or some hunter from Germany or whatever. And our main enemy here, although they were helped substantially by the federal government, but the main enemy with the State Department of Fish and Game, State Department of Natural Resources, who came in and said, look, the public's got to continue to use this land. You know, they've always been free to wander over it, they got to continue to be free to wander over it. And we're saying, look, this is private land. You made a deal with us. We gave up a lot of land to the public. We gave up most of the state to the public. Now, this is our land, and if we want people to wander all over it, that's fine, that's our decision. But if we don't want them to wander all over it, that's our decision too. Just like if you don't want us to camp in your backyard, you can kick us out. You know, and it's the same. And the state convinces it, and we battled for two years, 2.5 years, still going on in my left AFN in 1975. With the sort of Nixon Ford administration over that issue. And they wanted, hard for me to remember all this stuff. But, all right, let's say that we've got our needs, we've got coastal villages. Houses are all here. Coming down here somewhere, lake over here, maybe the stream. This is the ocean here. What they wanted was all coast, 25-foot easement. Anybody could walk anywhere. Both sides of all rivers, all streams, 25-foot easement. All lakes, 25-foot easement.
25-foot easements. All along waterways, sort of 1 acre stopping areas, say every couple miles apart, which were essentially recreation areas. People could pull in, camp, cook, whatever they wanted to do. I mean, not the kind of thing you generally, if you were a farmer in Iowa, let happen on your land. That was the state's position. In addition, the federal government tried to deal with the issue of energy and transportation development. How do you figure out where the roads and pipelines and railroads and all that's going to go? In 1973 or 74, the Bureau of Land Management made a big map of Alaska, and they developed something called the Multimodal Transportation Corridor System. And it had a little cover on the book with a map. And if you looked at that map, it looked like somebody had dropped a plate of spaghetti on top of it, because that's where all their corridors went, just every conceivable place. Well, they wanted all those designated. So if this is the village here, you know, maybe there's a big pipeline that comes down out of here. And it was like as much as four to six townships, which is like 24 to 36 miles, which would, you know, all the way back here. This is a village. That's what they wanted. Well, people figured out that the BLM and nobody else knew where any of that garbage should go. And even they had to admit, if they had their corridor here, they weren't sure they could ever use it. And even if the corridor took up this much land, they eventually might want to put it over here, so what use was it? Well, that's no problem, says the BLM. We'll just have floating corridors. They'll be wherever we want them to be. So they had a proposal that said basically any time they wanted to build a road, a railroad, or pipeline, all they had to do was build it. Now, if they go across, take a pipeline across somebody's backyard in Anchorage, they pay for that privilege. What they were saying is, we want free use. Even though it might be the oil companies, who certainly aren't the world's poorest people, they're using this, they get it free because it's native land. Well,
in most cases, they can force you into selling, right?
They can force you into it. But they've got to give you some money.
So they still can't afford it.
Yeah. Right, yeah. They can take it by eminent domain, but they got to pay. But the deal was here, they want it for free. There's no eminent domain, no saying, look, yeah, we're taking your land, we'll give you a little money for it. It was, hell, it's free. It's just native land. Yeah. It was their attitude. Well, we lost those battles, most of them. And they came out with a bunch of regulations that pretty much did all of this. So we said, well, we can't allow that to happen, so we went to court. And I said, as I said, there were two major points that AFN tried to promote, one of which was participation. The lawsuit on the easement situation tried to promote the second point that AFN felt was essential to the implementation of the Settlement Act, and that was that ANCSA is Indian legislation. And under our court system, East legislation is Indian legislation, and it's unclear as to what that legislation means. You got a choice. You can't figure it out. You decide for the Indians. So if there's a problem, like you can't figure out how many easements there should be because Congress wasn't very specific, you take the position that's most beneficial for the natives and still within the tone of the law. So the court basically told BLM to throw their regulations out. That floating corridors were out. They didn't know where the stuff was going to be built. Too bad. Get it later and pay for it. They said putting easements all along all the coasts and all the streams was way beyond anything Congress had ever intended. They cut those back to areas actually used. And basically what they said is, a position we'd always taken, the purpose of easements under the Claims Act was access across native lands. So if this is all native land in here, and this is the village, and you need to get to this BLM land out here, we'll give you an easement. People can walk along there, or they can drive their They could go across it. Congress did say that there should be easements across native lands. But that's all they could do. If they want to hunt and fish and camp, and they do it over here on the BLM land. And if we want them to hunt and fish and camp on native lands, then we'll tell them. And maybe they can do it for free, and maybe they'll be charged, but that's our decision. It's not the government's. That was, and in coming to that conclusion, the court said the reason we come to that conclusion is because the Claims Act is Indian legislation. And it's a responsibility of the government to decide things in favor of the Indian or natives. A critical decision, certainly the most important court decision we've had since the Claims Act passed. And it was not even appealed, which came as a big surprise to us. We thought that the state or the federal government would appeal it, but they did not. They sat down with us. Part of it was because, right, the decision came down, as I recollect, right after President Carter got elected. And so things started to change a little in Washington. Guy Martin, who had been Commissioner of Natural Resources, went back to Washington. He had been not exactly a friend of ours while he was Commissioner Natural Resources. He had a meeting with AFN before he got his appointment and said, look, I know there are a lot of problems with the Claims Act, and if I get appointed, you have my commitment, I'll go back and try to resolve those issues. And a promise that Guy carried out. And so the easement things were negotiated, it was never appealed. That lawsuit again was coordinated through AFN, and virtually all the easement work that was done in trying to negotiate with the federal government when they came out with the original BAD regulations was done through AFN, and the negotiations that were done after we won the lawsuit were done through AFN.
Was the state Supreme Court decision?
No, that was a federal district court decision. So it was brought in federal court because it's federal law. There's one other area that AFN has been very active in,